Welcome back to Insights Now. I'm David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist here at JP Morgan Asset Management. Over the past year, investors have been inundated with negative reports of elevated mortgage rates and empty office buildings, weighing on their sentiment towards real estate investing. However, real estate comes in many shapes and sizes, and each sector has its own fundamentals and use cases in the portfolio construction process. In fact, while some segments may look more attractive than others, valuations across the asset class have reset as rates have climbed higher, and investors searching for diversification, steady income, and inflation protection have an entirely new menu of opportunities to choose from. That being said, after nearly a decade of suppressed interest rates, real estate investors may have to recalibrate their approach for the return of a structurally higher cost of capital. To share how he's approaching the market against this backdrop of higher rates, I'm joined by Doug Schwartz, a co-president and portfolio manager within our Real Estate Americas platform. Doug has been with the firm since 2004 and has almost 30 years of industry experience across a range of functions, including transactions, asset management, and risk management. Before we begin, if you're listening to the audio version of this podcast, you can now watch along on YouTube by tuning into our JP Morgan Asset Management channel, linked to the show notes. Now let's get started. Doug, welcome to Insights Now.
Thank you for having me.
So, Doug, real estate is a very broad asset class with many different sectors. So where do you spend most of your time?
Sure. And before I start, maybe I'll say congratulations on another marathon on Monday.
Thank you. The Boston Marathon is always a struggle, but we struggle on. Anyway,
it's a big thing to be proud of. So I'm working on a new vintage fund, and what that means is we're in acquisition mode. So most of my time is spent on the road with acquisitions officers looking for new deals. And so what are we looking for to build this portfolio? It's really centered around two demand drivers. First is consumption. So it's mostly e-commerce, but also service consumption. So on the e-commerce side, it's really about how goods move through the supply chain. Mm-hmm. So that's truck terminals around ports and other transportation nodes. It's also industrial outdoor storage. On the service side, we really like neighborhood retail, or some people call strips, where there's medical, health and fitness, food, really strong fundamentals in those categories. And then on the housing side, that's the other demand driver that is really interesting to us. We like, in particular, single-family rentals in a build-to-rent format, so subdivisions. They run like horizontal apartments. That's probably our highest conviction sector right now, as well as affordable housing in certain jurisdictions and student housing. So there's a wide array of asset classes that we think we're getting rent growth out of.
And it does seem kind of ironic that given all your years of experience in this space, that you're actually able to devote your efforts to buying new stuff. And I think that it must be such an advantage because of all the weird structural changes that the pandemic and the sort of return of higher interest rates and the impact on affordability for housing, all these changes have really changed the landscape completely. So it's nice to be, instead of trying to deal with an old portfolio of assets, which have got plenty of problems, to be looking at, okay, now what should we be buying?
100%. So it's not just the pricing has changed, which of course is driven by the change in interest rates, but also just the whole way people and firms use real estate has changed dramatically in the last couple of years. And so to be able to build a new portfolio with that post-COVID lens, so to speak, is a big advantage.
Sure. I mean, I would have thought that the renting of single-family properties would be a much smaller business a few years ago than now, but of course, it's so much harder to buy.
There's several things driving it. It's harder to buy, and that's a function, of course, because a lot of people are trapped in their 3% mortgages,
sure.
And the new mortgage is so expensive. But also, it's just the bulge of millennials having kids and dogs, and typically one of the couple works from home, and so the whole idea of renting the home is very appealing for a renter today. We do it only in the new construction side, so we don't buy one at a time homes that were built by whomever,
exactly.
We like to control the environment.
Buried in the basement. Yes,
exactly. It's a much more cost-effective way to run the business.
Sure. So let me talk a little bit about interest rates, because obviously we've had sharp move higher interest rates, that has caused public markets to reprice very aggressively, although some of these markets have recovered. But can you say the same thing for private real estate transactions?
So the private...
Or valuations.
Yeah, the private assets, real estate assets, have definitely fallen in price with the rate hike cycle. To the tune, for the best assets, to the tune of about 20%. So most of, let's just take apartments, for example. The fundamentals are very healthy. And the rents have risen between, over the last 2 years while this rate hike cycle has taken place. Meantime, the values are down some 20%. Rents are up like 20% since then. So it's a pretty strong value proposition for the buyer to have these great fundamentals at the same time kind of off-peak pricing.
Mm-hmm. But the other thing that I guess, particularly when you look at sort of pre-pandemic years, the fact that the economy does seem to still be growing here and the Fed keeps on backing away from promised rate cuts, it looks like we're looking at higher rates for longer. Can real estate thrive in a higher rate environment?
I prefer it that way because high rates typically means we've got a good economy, fundamentals are strong, and the properties are growing. You know, the incomes are growing. So it also happens to be better if you're starting a new fund because the trouble with high rates is if you already own a portfolio of assets and you have to deal with refinancing.
Sure.
Typically, the new loan that you're getting to pay off the old loan is not as big as the old loan. So there's a deleveraging that a lot of owners of existing assets have to partake in over the next few years. And so they have to reserve capital for that. And so they're not in the market to buy new assets. So it's really challenging when you own a portfolio of assets. But when you're building a new portfolio, the high rate environment is great. And what it does to the prices is it brings great asset prices down below replacement cost. And when you're below replacement cost, you got a lot of room for rent growth before supply kicks in again. Mm-hmm. And that is really for core real estate investing and core plus real estate investing, that's where you want to be, is below replacement cost. Today you have that, strong fundamentals and pricing below replacement cost.
I suppose, I know this is a very broad generalization because the area is very broad, but it does seem like commercial real estate has held up better than a lot of people feared, particularly, say, a year ago. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, and certainly, we can take the office business and put it in one category because that's not holding up well with the work from home trends. But everything else has held up real well. And I think there's a couple reasons for that. One is the industry is just much more sophisticated than it was when I first got in the business. And so being able to predict supply and demand is much more accurate these days. And so really supply has not gotten out of whack in any meaningful way since the early 90s. And so that's made these downturns much more palatable. Now, a drop in demand is a real problem for real estate, and that's what office is going through right now. But in housing and in logistics and in retail, the demand is outside of B malls, the demand side's real strong. The housing dynamic is really interesting because what we said about there's no homes for sale because of the mortgage dynamic. There's a bulge of renters because of the millennial generation. And then you've mentioned this on this podcast many times, is the impact of immigration is actually really helping the housing market as well. So all those things. Then for the renter, you can only raise the rents as much as a renter can afford to pay them. At a certain point, they're going to move in with a friend or their parents, or they'll find another solution. Same with firms. They can find, for commercial real estate, they can find alternatives. But as long as we have wage growth and low unemployment, we can push rents in housing. So the situation is looks very good for investing in housing.
But are there any particular sectors that are buckling under the weight of higher interest rates as opposed to the other issues we're talking about?
I would say it's funds that are buckling under higher interest rates, not so much sectors. So the sectors that are buckling, and office would be one of them, and B malls another, are buckling because of the demand collapse.
Yeah.
The the funds are the ones that have the existing owners of assets are the ones that have difficulty with higher interest rates, whether they're in one sector or another. Mm-hmm. So we are seeing lender distress in the office space for sure. I mean, sure. There are a lot of examples over the last 18 months of properties that are being handed over to lenders, and lenders are having to deal with them where they're extending loans. That is going to create a fair amount of, or it is creating a fair amount of losses in the lender community. I'm not too worried about contagion there.
Yeah.
Because the lender base is so dispersed.
Yep.
Through the securitizations and syndications, that I think that it's not going to be one big group that collapses and then it kind of creates a big problem for everybody else. It's more of just a lot of institutions taking a small number of
So not 2008 all over again.
This is what I think. I mean, hard to tell. Yeah.
Okay. We hope not. We think not. But okay. So we talked about some of the negatives here. But where are the opportunities? What are the parts of the market you're most excited about?
Yeah. So I mean, just the fact that we can buy below replacement cost for high quality assets that have strong fundamentals is far and away the most exciting thing. Now, digging under, like, where are you finding those opportunities? It's some of the ones I mentioned before, which were single family rental, build for rent, affordable housing, and student housing, and then also truck terminals, industrial outdoor storage, and neighborhood retail. We also like infill industrial, so closest to the consumer, closest to the jobs. We're staying away from industrial that's out further afield. It's mm-hmm. a lot easier to replicate, and we think the rents ran too high in that category. And then traditional apartments is an interesting one because we had a huge supply wave, or we're in the middle of a huge supply wave right now. It's probably 12 months in, and we have another, let's say, 6 or 9 months of that. The market actually did a pretty good job projecting demand here. It's sure. getting absorbed. But the rents have been weak, you know, flat to down for the last 12 months.
Tell that to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, because they seem to think that rents are going up.
That's an enigma.
I know.
It's an enigma. I suspect that because there's this lag in the inflation data that they're going to show in the next 12 months that shelter inflation is dropping.
I know.
When it's just now it's starting to reaccelerate.
Yeah.
Also, what's happened is when the rate hikes went up in 22, the development shut down. Yep. So here we have a situation where we have a supply wave now, but in 6, 9, 12 months, that's going to start to wane. And we think the rent growth picture for 2026 and 2027 is very strong because there's very little product that's going to be mm-hmm. delivered then.
So I know this. I mean, you said earlier that you're involved in buying a lot of or putting new assets into a portfolio here. But what are the pros and cons of doing that rather than running a fund which is managing a lot of older properties?
Yeah. So for one, there's the advantage of buying at the discounts. Mm-hmm. That's clear. If you own an existing portfolio of assets, you have to handle the deleveraging.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to reserve cash. It may mean you have to sell an asset or two in order to refinance some other assets. So you're definitely not in the acquisition market. And that's one of the things that's really opening up the opportunity for new buyers. So that's a big advantage. The other thing is when you have a small fund that you're starting to grow, each acquisition that you make in this environment, it can be really impactful on return. Whereas when you have a big fund that's existing, you're really more reliant on the existing assets that you own. Each new fund is just not going to do that much for performance. Yep. You can try, but it's tough. There are also benefits in capital structure. So we have the ability right now to buy unlevered mm-hmm. and wait until some rate drop. Who knows when that happens. But the returns coming from the unlevered projections are almost where we want to be anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get almost all your return just from the real estate, not worrying about the leverage. And then the leverage is gravy later.
Yeah.
Whereas if you have an existing fund, you're kind of stuck with the capital structure that you had during this other period.
So now you've got all this rather expensive leverage.
Yeah, and each refi is painful.
Yeah.
So that's a big advantage. And then something I mentioned in the beginning of the call, which is just being able to build the portfolio with the post-COVID perspective is really it's an unappreciated piece of this thing.
I mean, it sounds like the only real downside is it's a lot of work finding the right properties and putting them all into a portfolio.
It's the fun work, yeah.
Oh, well, that's true. That is. I'm sure that's the case. Well, I was circling back to one question I sort of alluded to earlier. We are trying to forecast inflation, and the inflation numbers have been a little stickier than we would have liked to see so far this year. And as I look at it, a lot of this, I mean, of the 3.5% inflation that we saw in March and CPI, 2 full percentage points were shelter. Where do you think that's going to go?
It's so hard for me to understand, because I watch these rents, apartment rents in particular, every day. You know, we have a dashboard that tells us where our rents are landing. And the rents have been flat to down, as I said, for the last 12 months. So the fact that shelter is driving inflation is just... It's an enigma. So I think in the data you're going to see, like the Fed generated data, we'll have a calmer inflation for the next 12 months. That said, I like real estate for my own portfolio because I think it's a strong inflation hedge. And what I see happening, you know, particularly in apartments in 26 and 27 and 28, I like being protected, have that hedge, because I think inflation is going to reaccelerate during those years when the rents kick back up because we've had this lag of construction.
Well, yes, so long as the economy can avoid a recession, we get good real wage gains. But I think it just highlights the sort of how divorced the government's numbers on shelter inflation really are from reality of new leases being signed.
The other thing that's interesting is just the paradox of the Fed raised rates. Mm-hmm. Which cut off construction, which actually is pro-inflationary.
Absolutely. And you know, this is something we've talked about many times, is monetary policy has lots of perverse impacts. So they think they're slowing the economy down or they think they're speeding it up, and they may not be doing that.
Right.
And I think, you know, it's highly ironic that after 2 years in which they will be celebrating that they brought inflation down from 9 to 3, the only way they could have done that was slowing aggregate demand. But as you saw in the second half of last year, demand looks just great.
Right.
So it's not clear. It is clear that inflation has come down. And it is also, I think, partly because of shelter, clear that it's going to come down some more. It's not clear that the Federal Reserve did it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, interesting. But that's more my bailiwick than yours. But listen, this has been really fascinating, Doug. So I really appreciate you joining us here in Insights Now.
Thank you for having me on.
On our final episode of Season 9, I'll sit down with Anton Pill, Global Head of Alternatives at JP Morgan Asset Management, for discussion of the future of alternatives. To all our viewers and listeners, thank you for tuning in today, and speak with you soon.
This content is intended for information only, based on assumptions and current market conditions, and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. JP Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of JP Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.